Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program Jim Kaler. He is Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at University of Illinois, and every once in a while stops by here. We talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky.
I just drop in and hope there's nobody here.
Yeah, no, he's been very generous with his time over the years when we call. Sometimes at short notice, and he almost always...
Mr. Fill-In.
And if he can, he's always said sure, he would come over, and it's always good for us to have him here. If you have questions about astronomy, you can call in, and I know he will do his best to give you an answer. Perhaps we'll talk also a little bit about stars. That's a particular interest of his, professional interest of his. And in fact, he has just recently published his 14th book, which is The Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars, and it is published by the Cambridge University Press. And it's a book that if you're a fairly – your level of interest in astronomy is fairly serious and you're up to doing some fairly rigorous reading, as we were talking here before the show. It doesn't require that you have an advanced degree in astronomy. But for people who are really seriously interested in astronomy, I'm sure it would be a great book. And it also has some really nice photographs in it as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And questions here, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
It's good for looking stuff up.
Yes, it's a great, it's a I think that would be a good reference for probably some range of people, even people who are in your business, I expect.
Yeah, if you want to know a little bit about the field of stellar astronomy and you're a cosmologist, it's good reading.
And it does really have some great
photographs. I would hope it's good reading.
Well, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. One of the things we do usually when you were here, we ask you just for the beginning here, just to talk a little bit about what is noteworthy in the sky this time of year.
Well, we've got all night long here to look at good stuff, planetary sky at least. You can see Venus over there in the southwest right now just after sundown. If you look in fairly bright twilight, look for looks like a big airplane landing at Willard Airport if you're over in Urbana or Champaign, and it's not because it'll just sit there and very, very slowly descend toward the horizon. By the time the sky's dark, it's gone. But it'll get better and better, and it will make a lovely appearance in late spring and early summer. It'll get quite high in the sky and not set till quite late, and you can't possibly miss it if it's the brightest thing out there other than the sun and the moon. Mm-hmm. And coming up now in the early evening is Saturn. You can look to the east, almost due east, and it's rising directly west of a star called Regulus. So it looks like two of them coming up, one after the other. Saturn will be the western one of the two. Not all that bright, but it's comparable to one of the brighter stars in the sky. And then in the morning sky, if you're an early riser, you don't have to be early riser this time of year because the sun is getting up so late. If you look around 6 o'clock to the southeast, you'll see Jupiter, and you can't miss that either. It's about as bright as it can get, and doesn't rival really Venus, but it's usually the fourth brightest thing in the sky, sun, moon, Venus, and then Jupiter. Mars will top it out once in a great while when it's opposite the sun. But Mars is down there. It's rising about as twilight starts, but it's really tough to find in bright twilight. It's not all that bright.
Okay.
It is the god of war, after all. It's not all that brilliant. Oh, well.
Uh-huh. And it has that bloody cast.
Yes, it does.
You can always tell.
It's rust, you know. It's rust, actually. It's iron oxides in the dust and on Mars that give it the color.
Yeah. We have a caller. Go ahead and take a call? Let's do that. Danville is up here in line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was wondering if you could tell us where the oldest stars in the universe are and just give us a brief rundown on the lifespan of a star. I think that would be interesting to hear. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Well, interestingly, some of the oldest ones are not all that far away. They're sort of mixed around you. The galaxy we live in is a flat disk, and that's relatively young. Disk's about 10 billion years old. But it contains the stuff out of which stars are made. So you have in the disk stars that go back to about 10 billion years, and you got brand new ones that are forming right in front of your eyes. Surrounding this disk is a gigantic halo, very low population. Only about 2% of the galaxy stars are in the halo. But the halo's older. That goes back to around 12 or 13 billion years. And we can tell that from the ages of the stars that are in it. The halo, of course, pervades the disk as well. You know, it's because there are halo stars around us. So we can find locally stars that go back to about 12 or 13 billion years old, not too long after the Big Bang, quite honestly. And they're identifiable through their spectra. They're often identifiable rather quickly through their motions because the stars in the disk are all kind of going in the same direction. They're the ones that basically make up the constellation patterns, and they drift against one another. The constellation patterns fall apart after a couple of million years or so. But the ones in the halo just go plowing by us, and they're just high-speed critters, and you can pick them out by their velocities very frequently. And they're very low metal content. They don't have much in the way of heavy elements because stars manufacture chemical elements. And then as they die, they spew them back into interstellar space where new stars are born. So the iron content, for example, and heavy metal content of space is going up and up and up. So young stars tend to have high metal contents. Old stars have very low metal contents. So you can identify them that way too. The sun, you get stars like the sun, they're pretty stable. They're very stable. In fact, if they weren't stable over billions of years, we would not be here. Life requires this kind of stability. It's converting hydrogen into helium deep in its core. Core is about a half of the mass of the sun way down inside, and this is through thermonuclear fusion. And eventually the hydrogen will run out, sun's about 5 billion years old, take another 5 billion for it to run out. And at that point, all heck, as they say, breaks loose. The core collapses slowly, and then because it doesn't have any fuel supply, and then the outer part of the sun is going to expand. It'll expand past the orbit of Mercury. It does this a couple of times. There's a couple of cycles through which it does it after it quits fusing its hydrogen and then after it quits fusing helium, which it'll do for a short period of time. And it's expected actually at some point to expand in the next 6-7 or so billion years to about the size of the orbit of the Earth. This is not going to do the Earth any good. Especially since it's going to be 5,000 times more luminous than it is right now. So it'll wipe out the interplanetary system pretty well. And if it doesn't quite get to us, it will certainly turn us into a cinder. But it's your basic life cycle. And what will happen then is that the outer part of the sun will be lost to space. It'll just slough it all away in a gigantic wind, and the only thing that will remain is the dense core that used to have the fusion reactions in it. These dense cores are called white dwarfs. They shrink down to about the size of the Earth, and they're just all over the place. Now, how do we know this? Well, we see all these critters out there. We see giant stars. We see evolving stars in all kinds of different circumstances. We see these white dwarfs all over the place, and you string them all together with basic physics theory, and you explain everything quite nicely, in fact. I mean, you know, there's a lot of unexplained phenomena, but the basic idea is pretty well in hand, and the theories have been developing over the last half century or so. Now, you get a star about 10 times the mass of the sun, the big ones, and they go past hydrogen fusion, helium fusion, and they develop iron cores, which collapse, and then these stars blow up and then produce what are called supernovae. They're pretty rare, fortunately, because you don't want one very close to us. You get an exploding star within about a few tens of light years, and it'll actually damage the Earth, give you some idea of the power of these things. So there's stellar evolution in a nutshell.
All right. Well, other questions are certainly welcome on stars or anything else.
Well, there's nothing left to talk about. We've talked all about...
Okay. Well, in that case, thanks for coming. Lunch, drive right. Careful. Let's go have lunch. 333-9455, toll-free 800.
That's the most comprehensive question I think I've ever had on this show. It was great.
Well, it's a very comprehensive answer. Obviously, you have been over this territory before. Other questions are welcome. If you can think of another one, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I sort of cut in on you when you're doing your little opening because we had the caller. You did talk about things that are bright that you can see in the sky various times, Venus being the brightest thing after the sun
that's
and the moon.
Beautiful. If you're out in the country, as Venus gets up into the nighttime sky, which it will do, gets higher and higher this May or June or something, and if you live out in the country away from lights, go on and turn all your outdoor lights off, go on outside where it's really dark, and you'll see Venus casting shadows. It's that bright. And the shadows are eerie because Venus is a point source rather than extended. The sun's shadows are kind of fuzzy. Venus is just sharp and clear, but you almost have to be in the woods. You've got to be in a very dark location for it. You can also see it in full daylight. I've seen it a number of times. There's a little bright spot in the sky. You look away and it's gone, and then maybe you can pick it up later. It's tough to find, but once you find it, it's amazingly bright.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear about the appearance of Venus. Actually, I was sort of thinking that I had remembered seeing it last fall, just after sunset.
Is it different times of the year? And it flips back and forth between the nighttime sky and the daytime. The evening sky and the morning sky. It's the classic evening star, morning star, before anybody knew what it actually was. And it's coming up to an evening appearance. It'll then swing in between the Earth and the Sun sometime. Golly, when will this happen? Sometime next August. And then it will swing over to the morning sky and get quite bright there for a while. So we've got this just a beautiful cyclic object.
All right. Anything else that you would like to call our attention?
Well, it's at least presumably winter here in central Illinois. I think it is, and at least today it felt like it. Mm-hmm. If you get a clear sky going on around mid-evening, 10 o'clock or so, and just look at the south and look up, and there's Orion. You get some of the most beautiful and bright constellation patterns of the whole sky this time of year. And the chilly air tends to promote and the clarity that you can get sometimes in the wintertime without the high humidity of summer promotes twinkling, which is an Earth's atmospheric phenomenon. Stars don't twinkle really. I mean, they don't twinkle out in space or anything, which is why there's a Hubble Space Telescope. Although it's a noxious effect to an astronomer trying to see something with these stars jumping back and forth, it's really quite a pretty sight. And it's caused by refraction, and then you get dispersion of light like you get in a prism. And if you look down into the left of Orion, there's Sirius, the brightest star in the sky, and it's low altitude above the horizon. It just twinkles like crazy. I'll get probably a couple of calls every winter about what is that thing that keeps flashing and changing colors, and it'll look red, and then it'll look blue, and then it'll look white. And it's very, very attractive sight aesthetically. Although, again, if you look at a telescope, it just boils away, and it's tough to even pin down the position.
Mm-hmm. So is the reason that that's one of the constellations, it's probably the few it's very noticeable, you know what it is. Is it just because it's very dramatic? Is it somehow
the three stars in the belt represent the belt of the ancient hunter, Orion, which are right on almost exactly on the celestial equator. This is the line above the Earth's equator. And so it places it about halfway up the sky. You don't have to look directly overhead. You just look up a little bit, and there it is. And it's surrounded by several other bright stars. You look up to the left, there's Betelgeuse, which is kind of reddish. You can easily see the color of Betelgeuse. And you look down to the right, there's Rigel, and all these bright blue stars. One of the reasons that it is so prominent is that it's actually Orion is a physically associated group of stars. It's not a cluster, but the stars were sequentially born over more or less together out of the same gigantic cloud of interstellar material. It's called an association. It's not a cluster like the Pleiades, but they are related. And these associations produce some of the really most magnificent constellations of the sky because they're often bright, hot, blue stars, often not very far away. Perseus is pretty much the same thing. Scorpius in the summertime is kind of the same phenomenon. So you when you teach the subject, you always say, well, constellations aren't real. The patterns certainly aren't. They're just as viewed from Earth. And that you often will say the stars have nothing to do with each other. They're different distances and so on. But that's not entirely true. Many of the brighter constellation patterns actually are physically associated. Mm-hmm. But take a look when you find Orion. Look up and to the right. Take a look at the Pleiades. Now, there's a real star cluster. It's a few hundred light years away and very, very attractive, the so-called Seven Sisters. Looks a little fuzzy if you look at it with older eyes like mine and you focus in on it and then, oh, yeah, you can break it down into a few stars and good eyes can see seven, eight even.
All right. We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been watching the times of sunset and sunrise. And I would assume that around December 21st, you'd get the times of shortest, earliest sunset and latest sunrise, but it seems to not be the case. I've noticed that for a number of years. Can you tell me the why of that?
Sure. Good eye noticing that. Every once in a while, somebody will notice the symmetry around December 21st. The time of the solstice, when the sun gets as far south as it can get, is actually the shortest day. The shortest interval between sunrise and sunset. You can't beat that. But the earliest sunset is actually in and around December 7th, about 2 weeks ahead of the solstice, and the latest sunrise we're in pretty much right now, which is why it's so darn dark there in the morning when you go out either to run or feed the chickens or whatever we do in the early morning hours. It's about 2 weeks after the solstice. And that's caused largely by the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. The Earth's orbit is not entirely round, and when the Earth gets closer to the sun appears to speed up in its movement. It's against the background stars. So what happens in December is that between that and the tilt of the Earth's axis, which plays a role as well, the actual sun is falling behind its average position that you'd have if the Earth's orbit were perfectly circular. And as a result, it sets early. It's related to what's called the inequality of the seasons, which makes Northern Hemisphere winter about 3 days shorter than Northern Hemisphere summer. You don't get this asymmetry so much around the summertime because the sun is pretty much in its average position against the background stars. So the asymmetry and with the summer solstice is only a few days, but you really notice it in the wintertime. It averages out. You get the earliest sunset before a couple of weeks before the solstice, latest sunrise a couple of weeks after the solstice.
I mean, is there a text or something that I could more?
Yes, there just happens to be. It's almost like I asked this gentleman to call up. I've got a book on the subject. It's called The Ever-Changing Sky. It's probably got much more information in it than you'd ever want, but it is available in paperback these days. I don't know if they still stock it around here, but you can't get it, and there's a full explanation of the phenomenon in there.
Please tell me the title again.
The Ever-Changing Sky.
Thank you so much.
All right.
You're very welcome.
For the call. Our guest this morning is Jim Kaler. He is an astronomy professor, emeritus professor of astronomy here at the University of Illinois, has been with us off and on for a long time to talk about what you can see in the sky various times of the year. He is the author of a number of books, 14 of them, as a matter of fact. The new one is The Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars. It is published by the Cambridge University Press. And he has a number of others that deal with stars. You might also look at some of the other books, like maybe The Little Book of Stars or The 100 Greatest Stars. And there are some others. That was a
Millennium Project.
The 100 Greatest?
Yeah, yeah. That was like the 100 Greatest Movies, the 100 Worst Movies.
Well, I think we talked about that.
Fun.
That book that has all the has a photograph of each.
It has a photograph illustrating something about the nature of the star. And I just had more fun writing that thing and illustrating it, especially there's some of these white dwarfs are very rich in helium, for example. They're mm-hmm. called helium white dwarfs, and how do you illustrate that except for a little dot against the sky? So I went over to Schnucks and bought a whole bunch of helium balloons and tied them in the backyard and took pictures of them. So we've got the helium balloons. Anything like this to illustrate, it was just great fun to do.
All right. Well, you can go out and look for those books, and if you have questions, you can call us. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here is a caller in Danville, line 4.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I have a comment and a question. Comment you'd mentioned about going out on a dark night, and unfortunately, I live out here in the middle of the prairie, and there are no dark nights anymore because of the light pollution. When I was a kid, I could see stars at the horizon level, and now it's 35, 40 degrees off the horizon before you can even see any.
Yeah, it's tough. Even when you get out into the farms, the yard lights tend to light things up a little bit. I find when you get about 10 miles out south of town where I tend to go on occasion, southern sky isn't too bad. The northern is just killed by Champaign and Urbana. You've got to get about 50 miles out before you can get rid of them.
Yeah, and if you start off like morning driving to Chicago, it just continually grows.
Oh, yeah,
brightness.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why they've closed or are closing Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin. It's just too bright.
Yeah, yeah. The question that I have is Venus has always been associated with the feminine, and it's been a couple of years since I read the book, but In the Da Vinci Code, they talked about every 7 years, Venus produces a pattern across the sky in that 7 years.
Yeah, that's right.
That is the pentagram.
You can make anything out of anything if you push at it hard enough. Venus does, however, have a cycle. I thought it was 8 years, 7 or 8 years, and I can't remember which at the moment, where it repeats its nightly patterns. For example, right now you'll see it low in the southwest in the evening, and if you come back, and I think it's 8 years, it'll be in exactly the same position. The Mayans actually used this as part of their calendar, I believe, although anthropologists would know that better than I. People have looked into whether there's any physical relationship between the two planets in terms of some kind of orbital locking that does it, and it's possible, though it's never been proven.
Interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome. Right,
thanks for the call. Here in Western mythology, there is this, as the caller says, there's association between particularly Venus, Mars, male, female, love,
oh,
war.
Yeah, yeah.
Is does that carry to other cultures, or does everybody have a sort of a different association
I don't know. I've read a little bit about it. What I have, I've forgotten. They have to figure powerfully into almost all cultures because they're some of the brightest things in the sky. And, until we really started thinking about it and looking at it and examining them on a scientific level and doing the proper measurements, and, nobody knew what these things were. And so they tend to be strongly related to the gods, as we did. Venus, of course, it's pretty obvious why it was associated with the goddess of love and beauty. It is a strikingly beautiful object. Mars, on the other hand, is this reddish color. It's not really red. It's kind of a yellow-orange, and you can get into big arguments about the colors of stuff up there. It depends on your own eyes anyway. But it does have this reddish color and was related to the god of war, blood. Jupiter takes 12 years to go around the sky, visits each constellation of the zodiac once every year, and it's a different one next year. Now it's in Scorpius, and it'll be in Sagittarius next year. So it's sort of a stately moving thing. Well, king of the gods, Zeus, Jupiter, and all this. Saturn's farther away than Jupiter, slower moving, so it must be Saturn's father, Jupiter's father, Kronos, and the like. So Mercury goes zipping around like crazy. So in Greek mythology, it got associated with the messenger of the gods, Mercury. And so there's reasons why they are named as they are. It's not arbitrary. Mm.
And do almost all cultures name prominent stars and patterns and give them names?
A lot of them do, whether you could say all of them. I don't know. A lot of it's been lost, especially some of the Native American Southern Hemisphere astronomy. Indian astronomy has been lost because the elders who knew it are dying away. Mm-hmm. It's a source of it's rich cultural material. It really is. Probably the best known in this country is the Navajo, about which there's still many, many stories extant.
We did hear. I want to make sure we get this question and have a question from somebody who was calling in and didn't want to ask their question on the air. Was concerning a comet, and I think actually there was a comet.
Yeah, we just sort of half missed it. We had some bad weather around here. Comet. You think I can remember the name of it now? Doggone it.
Comet McNaught. Discovered it?
Yeah. Named after Robert McNaught, who is, I believe, a minister in Australia, who has a dedicated a lot of his time to discovering exploding stars in other galaxies. He takes a telescope out, just looks at them, and he picked up a number of them. He was the first person to see supernova 1987A in the Southern Hemisphere, which got quite bright, the closest supernova since Kepler, since several hundred years. And he's found a number of comets as well. And this thing, unexpected, it dropped in from what's called the Oort comet cloud. It's a way, this huge cloud of cometary nuclei that surround the sun out to probably halfway to the nearest star. And so it was completely unexpected. And then it got unexpectedly bright and it was quite visible in the western sky for a while. I tried finding it, though, and trees got in the way, and it was too late by the time I got around to being able to see it. But I got a call from a friend of mine up in Barrow, Alaska, where the sun does not shine this time of year. And at noon, there's this comet floating above the southern horizon. What is that thing? So it was quite visible, and there are a number of good photographs. You can put Comet McNaught into Google, and you have a number of rather nice images of it will pop up.
So if you didn't see it, it's too late.
It's too well. It'll be quite visible if you're in Chile and Argentina.
Yeah,
but it's dropping deep into the southern hemisphere and will no longer be significantly visible up here.
A little past the midway of this part of Focus 580, Jim Kaler is here. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at University of Illinois. If you have questions about astronomy and what you can see in the sky, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller here is in Farina, and that's line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. I've listened to these programs that talk about the end of the Mayan calendar, and report was that the 2012 date refers to the crossing of the solar system across the galactic plane. And is that true? And also, could you comment on how good of astronomers were the Mayans? I mean, that sounds like a pretty advanced observation. Also, could you talk about the black hole at the center of the supposed black hole at the center of the galaxy, and why wouldn't it, over time, just eat the entire galaxy? Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. That is interesting. I've never heard that before about the Mayans considering the crossing of the galactic plane. They didn't know it was a galactic plane, of course, but the Milky Way is very bright near the winter solstice. And you can make a point that that might be interesting to see where the sun. Now, you couldn't see that happen, actually, but by observing the things opposite in the sky at midnight, you can tell where the sun will be in another 6 months. So everybody knew where the sun was relative to the background, even if you couldn't see the background. And the Milky Way crosses the ecliptic plane very close to the solstices, both in the summer solstice and in the winter Milky Way and the winter solstice. Winter solstice, which would be the summer Milky Way because they're reversed from each other. But I hadn't heard that before. But I suppose that could be of interest. The Milky Way was a mysterious thing to everybody until Galileo turned his little telescope on the Milky Way and found, oh, look at that! It's just stars all over the place. And you can't tell that with the naked eye. So you've got this white path, and we have pretty much lost that with the light pollution we have. You get into a dark sky, it is a stunning sight. It's not something you have to look for. You can't possibly miss it. Yeah. All you got to do is look up, especially in the summertime. So that might have some mystical significance. The Milky Way was often thought of as the pathway of souls to heaven by a lot of cultures. The Inca thought of it as a river that fed their crops and brought water back up into the mountains from the oceans and so on. So everybody had a somewhat different view of it, but it was a mystical thing that was not understood. So it could have great significance to have the sun within the plane of the galaxy, within the Milky Way. If you know your constellations, Sagittarius, winter solstice and the center of the galaxy is in the constellation Sagittarius, and one of the astrons part of Sagittarius is three-star bow. Sagittarius is a centaur, is an archer, and often considered a symbol of wisdom and knowledge, actually. And there's also a set of stars that look like there's an arrow going through. You're going to sort of see a bow and arrow up there, and the arrow, if you know your constellations, the arrow points into the heart of the dark part of the Milky Way where there's all the dust, and it points right at the center of the galaxy. It's almost like the ancient Greeks knew, hey, let's get the arrow to point. It's a pure coincidence, but you can find the center of the galaxy by following Sagittarius's arrow down by a couple of degrees. You can't actually see the center of the galaxy from here in optical light because of all the interstellar dust that's in the way. But if you get into longer wavelength radiation, infrared and radio, it pops right out at you. And there is a terribly tiny, brilliant source of radio radiation coming out of the center of it, which has now been measured to be not much bigger than the orbit of the Earth, very small. And you can look at the stars that are moving in the general neighborhood of it, rather close to it, and they're moving like crazy. They're just moving fast under the influence of a very powerful gravitational field, and you can calculate the gravitational field at 2.5 million times the mass of the sun, and it's all stuffed into that one little sphere about the size of the Earth's orbit. You don't have much alternative except to conclude that that thing has to be a supermassive black hole. It won't eat the stars if the sun turned into a black hole, which it cannot. It would just go out, that's all. no radiation could come out of it, and you'd feel the same gravitational field here that you did before, and the Earth would just keep going around and around without any significant change at all. So unless the star gets close to the black hole at the center, nothing much is going to happen. But if it gets close through interactions with other stars, for example, because the star density is very high in there, and stars can interact with each other, one can actually accidentally get tossed close to the black hole then tears it up through tidal forces and eats it, which is probably the source of the luminosity of the thing, because black holes by themselves don't radiate. It's the surroundings. So the calculations are that this thing is surrounded by a disk of matter, interstellar matter and torn apart stars, that are some of which is falling into it and some of which gets shot out in high-speed jets. We see these phenomena in other galaxies actually much more easily than in our own, because they're not obscured by all the stuff that's in the way. And some of them are far more powerful than you get in our own galaxy. But it can't eat the whole galaxy, because it requires a star to get dropped down toward the center. And that's going to happen on occasion, but it's not a regular thing. And once the stars get far enough away, they don't get to the center in the first place, and they can't get eaten by the black hole.
Yeah. What formed this? What was it? Would it have been a big star before?
Nobody really knows the origins of these things, but it's becoming, I think, more and more clear that these black holes are very primitive. They are almost primordial, and they may have preceded the galaxies that formed around them. That's in one extreme, at least. But we can look out into the great distances where you're also looking back in time. If you look at it, something 5 billion light years away, you're looking at it as it was 5 billion years ago. And when you get out to great distances, these supermassive black holes become what are known as quasars. And the galaxies around them are very dim, and the quasars are exceedingly bright, far, far brighter. It's like we have sort of a dead quasar at the center of our galaxy. It's just minimalist quasar in our terms, so to speak, whereas you maximize them when you get to very great distances. So they look like they were much more active in the distant past than they are now. And that and a lot of other data sort of imply that they may be among the first things ever born in the universe.
Yeah. Well, if that was their first, then did that have something to do with the formation of the galaxy?
Undoubtedly. There are strong relationships between the size of the central black hole and the size of the bulge that surrounds the galactic disk. So they're clearly strongly related, but nobody really quite knows how.
Hmm. Well, other questions are certainly welcome here. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Jim Kaler is our guest. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at the University of Illinois and has been with us many times over the years to talk about astronomy and what you can see in the sky various times of year. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The closest star to us, obviously, is the sun.
Well, yeah, but that's, yeah.
But the next closest is
Alpha Centauri.
How far?
4 light years.
So how many?
You could spit from here to there. It's just so close.
How many million?
6 trillion miles in a light year.
6 trillion miles.
So it's pretty far away. You're not going to get there. Star Trek is fun, but nobody can figure out how to get to a star in any kind of reasonable time. You take a chemical, you could send a package there, but it would take tens of thousands of years to get there at any speed that we can launch anything at right now. We've got several spacecraft that are exiting the solar system entirely. They can't come back there at the escape velocity. The Voyagers, the Pioneers, they're gone. I mean, they're still accessible in a sense. The two Voyagers are still sending back data, and they're still within the confines of the solar, they're outside the planetary system, but they're still in the confines of the extended solar system. But they will eventually enter interstellar space.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to be there for a long time before they encounter another star.
And would they be capable of sending back data?
No. They're powered by plutonium oxide power packs, which provide the heat that the decay of plutonium provides the heat that produces electricity. And there should be enough there, the last I heard, to last to about the year 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got another dozen or so years left to them. The hope is that they will cross what's called the heliopause. The sun sends out a wind, which we're in, that the wind is responsible for filling our radiation belts, in part for making the aurorae and so on. And that wind just blows out through the whole solar system, but eventually it encounters the interstellar gases. And when it does so, it does at high speed and produces a shockwave. So we're living in a bubble. That in a sense sort of keeps some particles, interstellar particles, out. And we don't entirely know where it is, and there's good physics for it. It's reasonably well understood, but we'd like to have observational confirmation of what we think we know. And it's going to be sort of touch and go as to whether the Voyagers will actually cross the heliopause before the power packs die or not. It's sort of a racing game at this point.
Okay. Well, we have some other questions. Let's talk next with someone in Terre Haute, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface of the moon, there's a formation that I believe it's called a Great Wall or something like that.
Yeah, it is. That's right.
Okay. It's like at certain times it'll cast a shadow that's very easy to see.
Yeah, you got to see it almost at a particular phase or it's not visible.
Okay, so what phase is that?
Doggone it, I can't remember. I think it's sort of in a waxing. You see it in a waxing gibbous phase. I'm sort of taking a shot at it. It's not far from our imbrium, but you've got to have the terminator, the day-night division on the moon, fairly close to it, so it'll cast a shadow so that you can see it. And I think it's in the waxing gibbous phase, but I'd actually have to look it up.
Sure.
That's about the best I get. It's a fault.
Right.
It's you get these things on the Earth as well.
Okay.
They're fairly rare on the Moon. They're more common on Mercury, but that's the only one I actually know of.
It's like a tectonic plate.
Yeah, except the Moon doesn't have tectonic plates, but it there's some shrinkage, and there's probably minimal. We're back to minimalist movement again. It's one plate. It's a single crust. There's no divisions, but. It doesn't seem to be related to impacts, so it's probably some kind of a slip fault of some sort.
Huh. Well, as the face of the moon that faces us, is it near the north-south axis, or is it left of that or right of that, or do you recall?
It's pretty much in the center. I'm trying to go back. I don't have a map of the moon with me. But I think it's pretty much centered a little bit off to the left as to the east, I think, is viewed in the sky. To be to the right is viewed in a telescope, which puts things upside down.
Okay. I've
seen it. I'm just trying to remember. I don't have that good a memory exactly where it is.
Yeah, I saw
it. It's a nice sight.
Several years ago, I was at the ISU's observatory, and it was very easy to see it.
Oh, yeah. And then you look at a different phase, and it's gone.
Yeah, right. I imagine
it. The moon is one of the most remarkable things to look at in a telescope. People tend not to do it because it looks so common, but the shadow structures, the craters, can be just strikingly beautiful.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, thank you. Next caller is in Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering, what do you recommend is a commercially available computer program for a personal computer for looking at the stars and the constellation and so forth that would be good for children high school age or even down to grade school age?
I'm sorry. I don't keep up with computer programs, and I honestly can't answer that. There are a number of planetarium-type programs. I would recommend that you call Dave Leake out at Parkland College, out at Starkle Planetarium, and I think they can probably give you a better handle on that than I can, because I just haven't kept up with it.
Okay, thank you.
But try Parkland. They're a great resource. And if you've never gone out there, by the way, go on out to Starkle and see some of their shows.
There.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
Great
thank
facility.
You.
You're welcome.
All right, well,
sorry I couldn't help
you.
More.
The questions are welcome. 333-WILL, and that's 9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. So it's presumably there are programs that would show you
what's up in the sky at any given time. Yeah, there are quite a number of them. But I don't have any of them myself because I don't need them. I know what's up there. They're kind of fun to play with, but I have never kept up with them. And I get a little bit irritated with some of them because they go a little off center. They're one of the best known ones, for example, will give you the distance to a star to the 10,000th of a light year, which is just absolutely silly because you can't measure anything that accurately. So there are some things about them I don't care for. But some of the software is really actually pretty nifty, okay, to use an old-fashioned word.
Nifty.
Nifty.
We had a caller who wanted to know, why does the moon move away from the Earth? Does the moon move away from the Earth?
Yeah, and there's two answers to that. Its orbit is, to a very poor approximation, elliptical. It's not even really a good ellipse because of the influence of the sun. It's a pretty complex orbit. But it goes a little bit farther away and then a little bit closer to us over the period of its monthly 27.3-day actual cycle, through perigee when it's closest to the Earth, through apogee when it's farthest from the Earth. So it's always changing its distance, and the range is about 11%. From closest to farthest. You can't see this with the naked eye. This has nothing whatever to do with making the moon look big when it rises. That is strictly an optical illusion. You can photograph it, but you can't really see the effect. It's too small. The other answer to it is that the moon is, in a secular sense, moving away from us. That is, its average position is also moving away from us and has been over the last several hundred million or last few billion years. On the average, the moon gets farther away from the Earth by about an inch per year. And that is calculatable. It's also measured because the astronauts left mirrors on the moon, and you can hit them with lasers, and you can actually make measurements of how far the moon is away to within a couple of inches or so. And sure enough, it's moving farther and farther away. It's a result of tides. The moon raises tides in the Earth's waters. That's the primary source of it. The Earth's rotation drags the tidal bulge forward a little bit. The tidal bulge then acts back on the, as a gravitational effect, back on the moon, and all of that slows the Earth down in its rotation, which is why you throw leap seconds into the year once in a while. So the Earth's rotation is slowing, and that factors into that energy, and that rotational angular momentum goes into the moon, which then moves farther away from us because the whole thing is sort of a semi-closed system.
Well, that's interesting.
But it's a tidal effect.
I guess I knew that the reason that we have tides at all are because of the moon.
And the sun. The sun has about a third the effect of the moon.
Ah. But those tides also do have an effect on the moon. Mm-hmm.
The Earth raises a powerful tide in the moon. It's in the moon's solid body. The moon doesn't have water. But the moon raises a solid tide in the Earth, too. I mean, rock is not infinitely hard. And every time the moon goes more or less overhead, you rise up about half a meter, I think the number is, or something. You don't notice it. But now that dissipates rotational energy, and that goes into the orbit of the moon, and the moon moves farther away, and its period gets longer. I think you can actually see this looking at ancient tidal records in rock. You can see that the moon was at one point much closer to us and moving around us much faster. And tides are very sensitive to distance. They go as the inverse cube of the distance. So that variation between perigee and apogee of the moon factors into about a 30% variation in tides. You get a high tide when the moon is close to the Earth. It's quite different from high tide when the moon is farthest from the Earth. So the tides are much higher than they used to be. So all this is a dynamical effects that just keep going on and on and on. None of this is stable and stationary.
Mm. If the moon continues to get further away, is there some point at which the gravity of the Earth is no longer going to hold on to it?
No. What will happen is that the Earth is slowing down. The Earth has stopped the rotation of the moon relative to the Earth. The moon keeps one face pointed toward the Earth. That's why you see the same pattern on it all the time. Yeah. Rotates relative to the sun. So there's day and night on the moon, about 2 weeks long each, but not with respect to the Earth. The Earth is slowing down, and what the moon is attempting to do is to slow the Earth down so that the Earth keeps one face pointed toward the moon. So we have full synchronous locking. Pluto and its satellite do that. And then they each face each other, and then they don't slow down anymore, full locking. I think the time scale for that is longer than the lifetime of the sun. I may be wrong on that, but it's very, very long because the Earth is so massive, it's not effectively going to happen. But the moon will continue to move farther and farther away. The biggest effect is the moon right now has a half a degree angular diameter. It's the same as that of the sun. So the moon can fit over the sun exactly. And you get an eclipse of the sun. Mm-hmm. Eventually, you won't be able to do that anymore because the moon will get farther away. Its angle in the sky will get too small. And, I can't remember. I remember looking it up once. It's a few million years. Eclipses will stop. You'll get eclipses, but the annular kind, where the moon can't cover the sun completely.
Well, we won't be.
We're just in a lucky time.
Speaking of Pluto.
Speaking of Pluto. Let's not speak of Pluto. Oh,
you don't want to speak of Pluto?
Sure,
all right.
Why not?
All right. Oh, I'm just curious about the continuing sort of hoo-ha about Pluto's being downgraded.
Yeah, apparently, I read over in the paper over the weekend that it's become, at least in Britain, a word to become Plutoed is to be ejected from your group or
Dennis Barron was on the other day, and we were talking about how it's the American Dialect Society, something like that. It's a group that every year looks at words, and they pick a word of the year, and that was their word of the year, Pluto. And Pluto. Dennis and I both looked at each other and said, "I have never heard this. I've never seen it in print. Plutoed. That was completely new to me. But that's what it meant. It would mean to be demoted.
The problem was that they discovered another body that's bigger than Pluto. It's much farther away, but it has sort of the same behavior patterns. It comes in very close, comes inside the orbit of Neptune, and then goes way, way, way out, much farther than Pluto. But Pluto changes. It goes from 30 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun to 50. None of the planets do anything like that except Pluto. Pluto's tilted. The orbit's tilted. It winds up outside the zodiac. It's tiny. It's about the size of the western United States, from Mississippi on. It's not very big. And there's whole bunches of objects like it out there, several of which, a good fraction of which, are actually locked into their orbits because of Neptune. And Pluto is one of them. So it really belongs to this Kuiper belt that's out there. Nobody understood that till we started picking up the fainter ones. Pluto just happens to be the brightest and the closest of them. It got turned planet because it was the only one known. Now it falls into a somewhat different category, and people have been trying to make sense out of that. But, if you want to call it a planet, nobody's going to stop you. It's an honorary planet. How's that?
There might even be some astronomers who would say, now, wait a minute.
Yes, there are, in fact.
A bit hasty when we did that.
I think it was the Planetary Division of the American Astronomical Society, or it was a professional planetary group that actually filed a web petition against the International Astronomical Union to try to get the decision reversed, because they were very unhappy about this. It's a planet. It isn't. What to make a definition, it gets so complex that it gets difficult to teach to school kids. A planet is what you call a planet. You can say that and throw Pluto in, and what the heck? It's a transition object in the sense between the planetary system, the true planetary system, which are the big ones, and the four inner ones, which aren't all that big, but they're isolated. They're nothing to compete with them. And this vast realm of debris, this Kuiper belt, there's 1,000 objects that have been found out there so far, and several of them rival Pluto. So you can see why you want to – it's not a demotion. It's just moving it into a different category.
Do some of these other things that are bigger than Pluto, do they have moons?
Yes. Pluto now has its Charon, its big moon. Two more were discovered. So it's got three satellites in orbit around it. And the famed UB-313, which was called Zena for a while, and I can't remember its current name, I just forgot it, has its own satellite as well. And who knows how many more. There are a number of binary and double Kuiper belt objects. Some of the big ones have satellites. Even the asteroids have been found to have satellites.
Right, very good. Let's get one more caller here when we still have some time in Mattoon, line 4. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you. This is extremely uncomplex. You've been discussing complexities. Tell me, what is the very bright object I would see looking out a west window in St. Paul, Minnesota?
This time of year?
Yes.
In the early evening?
Yes.
That's Venus.
Well, that's what I thought.
Yep.
It must be.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
One of my kids wanted to know. They thought for a minute they were going to be attacked.
Oh, I had such a beautiful view of it. My wife and I were on our way to St. Louis last week, and you get out into the country, out in the interstates in the real flatland out there, and it was brilliant. It was just beautiful. You followed it all the way. You could even see it once you even got into the city, except, you can't look at it too long because you're trying to drive at the same time. But it's hard to miss out the corner of your eye. It was just glaring down at us. It was a beautiful thing.
The information.
Oh, keep your eye on it. It'll just get higher and higher in the sky over the next couple
of
months.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right.
Well, that is definitely something to look for because, as we've said, it really is an astonishingly beautiful object.
And if you can get a telescope, it's fascinating because right now it's in it goes through phases because you only see part of the daylight side unless it's exactly opposite the sun on the other side. Right now it looks like a gibbous moon, very small. Mm. And as it gets brighter, it'll get closer and closer to the Earth at the same time, and it'll go through a half phase, and then when it gets really bright, it'll be in a big crescent phase, which is almost visible to the naked eye, not quite. There have been stories of children with really good eyes who will say, "Daddy, what is that thing?" in whatever term, you know, it looks like a crescent or whatever. But with even a small telescope or binoculars, you can see the crescent when it's about to pass to the other side of the sun.
Mm-hmm. And so that's in the look in the southwest.
Yeah, but you won't see any surface features because it's perpetually cloudy. You think the Midwest is cloudy, try Venus. You can't see the surface at all. Mm-hmm. None of it.
It does have a solid core.
Oh yeah,
though,
it's about the size of the Earth. It's a little bit smaller than the Earth. It's sort of a twin of the Earth in that sense, but it's covered with sulfuric acid clouds and impenetrable.
Right. Well, I guess about that point, we'll finish up for this time around with the promise that I'm sure that Jim will come back on another
okay.
day. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jim Keeler.
He is an professor of astronomy emeritus here at University of Illinois and has authored a number of books about stars. If you're interested in books on stars, this guy is your man. Go down to the bookstore and take a look at, you could look at the 100 Greatest Stars or the Little Book of Stars. Or the brand new one, which is the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars. It's the Cambridge University Press. That one is just out. It's his 14th book.
Right.
Very good. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
It.